I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com. Before we get into today's episode, a couple of resources that I'd like to share with you. The first one is the book that I helped Dr. Garth Davis write. It's called Proteinaholic, and I would love for you to buy it for friends, to blog about it, share it on social media, and even leave an Amazon review if you feel like it. That will help us spread the word and get the message out there that we really don't need to be obsessed about protein, that it's almost impossible to be protein deficient on a healthy diet, meaning a plant-based diet, and that we are suffering as a society from what we can only call protein toxicity, way more protein than we could ever use, and it's making us sick. So again, the book is Proteinaholic. Second thing is, if you know someone or if you yourself are struggling with your health, and you'd like someone to hold your hand and lead you out of the medical mill and into true wellness, that's what I do for a living. I have a practice at trianglebewell.com, and I consult with people. I help you with the research if you have a particular condition. And if you decide that lifestyle change is going to be a part of your treatment, then I help you with that as well. I do individual coaching, group coaching, and classes, both local and online. So if you are struggling with health, or you don't know where to turn, or you feel like you've been pushed around like a pinball in the medical system from one doctor to another, from a specialist to another specialist, and nobody hears you, nobody listens to your story, and everyone is just looking at a fragment, then give me a call. You can visit me at howard@trianglebewell.com. or hj@plantyourself.com. Both of those will work, and I'd be happy to set up a time to have a chat and see if there's a way for us to work together. Now on to today's episode. My guest, Samantha Carey Johnson. The first thing that got me about her is that she's a reality TV star. She is one of the guest coaches on the MTV show Made. She also is a former Miss Pennsylvania and a Miss USA competitor. And whatever you think of beauty pageants and that whole world, if I had known that it was going to take a podcast to get me to talk to a beauty queen, I would have started podcasting in seventh grade. Seriously, Samantha is anything but shallow. If part of your assumptions about beauty queens is shallowness, as I have to admit it kind of was for me before I had the interview. Samantha is a fascinating human being. She's only 30, and she's already spent half of her life in the food industry. She attended a school that has a heavily animal agriculture base, and yet she has been plant-based. She's an outspoken proponent of the plant-based lifestyle. She's a personal chef. She's a consultant to restaurateurs and other people who want to make it financially in the plant-based world. And she is a strong advocate of organic farming, gardening, and bringing healthy produce to underserved communities. So you can see the beauty queen bit and the MTV bit are kind of the icing on the cake. So without further ado, Samantha Carey Johnson, welcome to the Plant Yourself podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you've got a long list of accomplishments, of kudos, and a lot of the stuff you're doing is really well outside of my world, my understanding. A lot of it's kind of glamorous, so I want to make sure, you know, I'm not sort of stuttering. But we'll get to all that. But let's just start by just talking about like what you're up to now, as you say on your website, what you're about.
Sure. Well, I currently work as a personal chef and consultant within the plant-based and whole foods health-focused realm. I also am a writer and I also am a host, and all within the plant-based health-focused food realm.
Gotcha. So I understand what a personal chef is. What does a plant-based consultant do?
So I have 15 years experience, half of my life in the restaurant industry, restaurant and hospitality industry. And with a lot of businesses going into the direction of, you know, juice bars, plant-based cafes, a lot of these people going into that realm actually don't have the experience, whether that is in the restaurant industry or just within the plant-based realm. And sometimes, you know, they're lucky enough to call on a consultant. And so I act as a consultant for those businesses doing that.
Gotcha. So all those places that I pass and I look in and I say, oh, my God, they have so many things I could eat. And I look inside and I go, oh, they're not going to make it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot that goes into the restaurant industry. And a lot of times, you know, people go into it with these, you know, high goals and high expectations, but the restaurant industry is one of the number one failing businesses, you know, to go into. It's a really tough ride, and being plant-based and health-focused doesn't help. You know, a lot more people are going in that direction, and that's amazing, but you really have to be smart and strategic before opening up a plant-based food business.
I remember talking about a year ago with someone who had become an ethical vegan, but at the same time was holding the reins of a restaurant that, if it had gone vegan, would have closed down within a week. And she was really struggling with, you know, with the ethics of that, with the strategies, which you like try to fake people out and like make fake things. It's a hard thing to do, and especially if you're if you're approaching it from an ethical or a mission perspective, I'm guessing that you can become a little blinded to some economic realities.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, especially on the ethical vegan side. It's tough. I mean, I mean, your ethics are failing at that point if you're still procuring meat, animal protein for a business that, you know, gives you sustenance and monetary anyway, and then but your core soul and spiritual beliefs are in complete contrast. They don't really match up. No.
All right. Oh, that's great stuff. I'm glad to hear there's people out there doing that, and especially, you know, someone like you with so much personal and family experience in restaurant and hospitality.
Yeah.
So let's segue into your story. I was spending a lot of time on your website, SamanthaCareyJohnson.com, looking over your bio. And so, you know, some of the things that caught my eye were you had a pretty serious illness as a teenager.
I did. I had a pituitary tumor. And so it's essentially a brain tumor. And I battled with that for about 5 years. And I had surgery just before I turned 20. So it's about 10 years out of that experience, which is amazing. I, you know, blinked of an eye, 10 years. But it was a pretty painful experience. But I learned a lot about, you know, just my health and myself and listening to your body intuitively and knowing when something isn't right. And I'm just fortunate to have gained that experience and come out of it successfully and being able to carry on further. But yeah, it was a pituitary tumor. Your pituitary gland controls the hormones in your body. It's a part of your endocrine system. And so it's a serious thing. It's a very serious thing.
Right. And I'm imagining for, you know, in addition to the health consequences, a 14-year-old girl with out-of-control hormones must have been interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just getting to the nitty-gritty of my symptoms is that my body was essentially acting as if it was pregnant. And of course, I hadn't even had my first kiss until I was 20. So that was wildly so not even possible. But yes, I mean, my breasts, I was lactating basically, and I didn't have a period. So my body was acting as if I was pregnant because the tumor was on my pituitary gland and produced a certain amount of hormonal, you know, chemicals that made my body think that it was. So there was a lot going on. You know, and I didn't understand it, but I knew something wasn't right. So it's like I had my period as a kid, and then I wasn't menstruating, so that was wrong. And then all of a sudden, I have breast milk. That's the crazy thing, you know. And so time to go to the doctor. You know, something's wrong.
Wow. And how did that affect your relationship with your body? Did it suddenly feel like, you know, something really alien that you couldn't count on anymore, or did you find strength? Like I'm really struggling to imagine to any extent what that must have been like.
Yeah. Surprisingly, no, I definitely felt oneness with myself. There wasn't a detachment from my body and questioning what it was. I actually was, you know, my grandfather was a physician and my aunt was actually the doctor who she's a physician as well, and she's GYN, OBGYN, and she actually was my mother's doctor when I was born, and she was actually the doctor who diagnosed me. So I was surrounded by people who said it very matter-of-factly, like, oh yeah, you have a pituitary tumor in your head. And I was like, what? At 14, I was so shocked, but, you know, coming from a medical family, it was a situation where I guess, you know, it's almost like when a kid falls, like, don't react, otherwise they'll cry, you know, one of those things. So it's like, because they didn't react, I didn't react. Now, I also could possibly just come from people who are very non-reactive emotionally, and I didn't pick up on that. But nonetheless, I think that because no one thought of it as a death sentence or something that was really going to inhibit my life, or at least didn't want me to carry on that emotional baggage, I didn't carry that on, and I just believed that I was going to be okay. I think also because although the tumor was there, it was non-malignant. Uh-huh. So it wasn't a cancerous tumor. It was just a tumor that was large, that was somewhat increasing in size, and that over time was extremely painful and debilitating. But I also, you know, had that foundation of eating healthy. My mother's a chef. You know, my father had me eating, you know, raw food, juicing and brushing my teeth with baking soda when I was a kid. So I came from a health-focused background, although it wasn't strongly, of course, it was just a natural part of my life. So still being able to be connected with my body and knowing my health risks and potential for anything was always just there.
Gotcha. So how did that incident play into your current, you know, plant-based lifestyle and advocacy? Did that convince you of anything? Were you on that path anyway?
What led me more to my, you know, plant-based vegan lifestyle was more so my connection to food growing up, less of my health and just more of my love of food. And my love of all things like fresh and vibrant, you know, I don't know why. I love, you know, like Southeast Asian is, I would say, like the baseline to the food that I prepare. I grew up with all kinds of people around me and in my world and who were friends with my parents. But Southeast Asian food, just the vibrance of it, the texture, the color, the taste, the crispness, that to me is food. Like I love tasting living food. And that's like the essential component of raw food lifestyle, vegan lifestyle, raw food, vegan lifestyle. And that just always resonated with me. I never was attracted to meat. Although, you know, in my day, I loved a juicy, bloody steak. You know what I mean? I can't say that I didn't. You know, I absolutely did. But, you know, it's like today I lean more toward ethics when it comes to the meat. But also, I just generally don't really have a taste for it anymore. I don't like food that is carcinogenic. You know what I mean? I don't like food that overcooks and doesn't really suit my body well.
Right. Now, you it looks like, kind of grew up in an environment in which certain types of meat were encouraged. I guess, you know, I don't think any of the restaurants that your family was involved in were vegan, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, meat was definitely a part of my life. Not a strong part, but, I mean, my mother is a Creole chef. I owned a Creole restaurant with her. But, and I can tell you, yeah, we had, you know, seafood gumbo on the menu. We had, you know, a pork chop on the menu at one time. We may have had a steak. There was definitely components to the menu of the restaurant that I owned that had meat, absolutely, without a doubt. And that was just a reflection of, you know, the food culture of Creole cuisine. But in the restaurant that I owned with my mother, I tried to skew it more farm to table, I think, was the edge that I tried to kind of curtail and cultivate that fresher, vibrant edge to the menu and to the food that we served. And so it could be less dependent on meat because, you know, Southern cuisine is heavily focused on meat. I don't like pork. I never liked pork even when I was eating meat. And pigs are smarter than dogs. So no, I'm not okay with that, you know?
Right.
So
now you went to W.B. Saul High School, which is in certain circles a really well-known agricultural high school, part of the Pennsylvania public school system. And Pennsylvania, you know, is like, you know, Penn State, one of the top ag schools in the country. I was looking at their website in preparation for this interview. They seem to be pretty livestock heavy. Did you find that challenging?
I didn't find it challenging. Although they have a meat lab program, like a butchery program, for example, which I actually did have to take, you know, as a 13-year-old, I learned how to break down a chicken properly as a butcher would. But it isn't like the animal husbandry programs at Saul High School where I attended. It's more so how to raise an animal, how to take care of an animal, permaculture, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Not so much. But I'll be honest, I didn't go into that track. I mean, you have two ways to go, left or right. And I went the right way for me, which was the plant, horticulture track.
Right. So the other track that, you know, is really interesting is you're a beauty pageant contestant and big time winner. How did you get into that?
Well, I studied film in college and throughout my entire life, I guess ever since I was 5, 6, 7, I was performing and acting and modeling. And that was my number one thing. That's what I always wanted to do and be. And so went to college for film. I was supposed to go into a theater conservatory after college. And, you know, as life happens and parents being parents and whatever, you know, I just say everything happens for a reason. So I was supposed to go into a theater conservatory. I ended up not going. And then I had to troubleshoot my situation. And so a friend of mine competed in the Miss DC pageant a year before me. And I was like, well, she did it. I can do it. And so I did it and I won. And it was as simple as that. I've never aspired to be a pageant girl. When I was a young kid in modeling, we definitely got a couple, you know, pageant pamphlets that were sent to the home. But my mom was like, no, you're not going to be a pageant girl. And so I didn't do pageants. You know, although I was interested, she said no. And so I said, okay. And I never thought about it since. Until, of course, I actually competed in one.
So what was it about that first experience that made you say, I really like this?
Well, what I really liked, I used to model. So being on stage and being in front of a camera and performing in a sense, I was used to and I always enjoyed. But I didn't like the I guess, like, fakeness, I don't know, I guess, in pageantry. And I like being myself. You know, I like being real with people. I like being honest. I like people to be feel. I like people to feel relaxed when speaking with me, because I want that from them. You know, and when I realized that I could be myself in front of the camera and use that platform of being Samantha Carey Johnson, Miss Pennsylvania, or just Samantha Carey Johnson, whoever I may be and become, is when I really started to like Miss Pennsylvania. And that's actually when I decided I didn't really want to be an actress that much anymore. And there you go.
Huh. So when you talk about the, you know, the fakeness, I think those of us who don't participate, who just sort of watch it, and we see, you know, the national pageants, or we, you know, watch Honey Boo Boo and stuff like that, you can get pretty negative impressions of that industry. What, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to frame the question. I mean, it seems given who you are now and the consciousness that I get from this conversation and from your website and from your work, that there's a fundamental disconnect in my mind between sort of the basic premise of a pageant is sort of an objectification of a woman's body, and the work you do, which is so deep and spiritual and healing. I hope this isn't an offensive question, but I'm trying to figure out how to bridge that in my mind.
Right. Well, I mean, to be honest, yes, the pageant world is extremely shallow, and there is nothing shallow about me. However, in taking my business and my mission to the lengths and levels and heights that I want it to, I mean, I have to stand on a public platform, and I started in entertainment. I started with being a person that was visual, visually accessible is I guess maybe what I should say. And I think, you know, there's always going to be a place for that. There's always going to be an industry for models. There's always going to be an industry for actors and actresses and singers and anyone in entertainment. And a part of me is still that. It's just that the things that I speak about are things that I care very deeply about, which are political, which are food focused, which are health oriented, which are moving to a lot of people, which are ethical. You know what I mean? All of these things. So it's like I just have these two dimensions of myself that I'm able to bridge the gap by way of just being an example.
Mm. So it's almost that the visual accessibility, as you put it, is a tool in your toolkit.
Exactly.
Just to speak to a culture that is you're trying to rouse from a kind of shallow stupor.
Yeah, quite frankly, yeah. I mean, you asked me about the separation of my body and self, and I feel like today, actually, in my oneness of self, or at least oneness within my spirituality, I feel more disconnected from my body than ever.
Really? Say more about that.
Well, I mean, just as you said, my body is a tool. You know what I mean? In my transition to being more plant-based and being more, you know, health-focused and less processed and all these things, I mean, I've been more aware of my external shell actually in this process. I've lost weight. I'm a woman, you know, I live a chemical free life. I'm not on conventional birth control, which makes your hormones fluctuate. I've lost weight. You know, I've taken note of that. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of pressure, you know, as being a woman and being someone who is in the public eye in whatever capacity, and also gets paid a living for looking a certain way. And then when you kind of retract from all of those things just in our general society that we're subjected to, that have had a physical effect on your life and on your physicality that you didn't realize, but then you realize but then you're faced with the side effects of being not processed, you know, you just see changes, you know, and even more so, you then see how you have to adjust to get to, and what will reflect when you go back into that public eye or when you expose yourself in whatever capacity. So as I use my body or my physicality or my physical presence as a tool to share my message with people, people see that and people see the difference in response to that. It's like, you have to be healthy. You have to be in shape. You have to be fit. All of those things. And then as you change from a process to an unprocessed life, to a chemical free life, you have to adjust to those changes and be more diligent and be more focused and be more aggressive.
Mm. Meaning that the purer you are, to use a word that I'm not crazy about, but maybe fits here, the less you can tolerate, you know?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Less you can tolerate, unless you're, and the more you are sensitive to physically and mentally and spiritually, absolutely.
Right,
and you know, so not in a bad way.
Well, we tend to think of sensitivity in one sense is a bad thing, like, oh, she's so sensitive, and, you know, people, oh, you know, if you have a cookie, you'll break out, you're so sensitive. But imagine if the entire planet became that sensitive.
Yeah, I mean, it would be an incredible thing. If the entire planet became so sensitive to the point where they actually feel the vibrations of, you know, they can read something and become emotional or actually want to do something about it. I mean, that's how things change. I mean, I'm a Scorpio, you know, like, I'm a Scorpio by nature, and we're very intuitive beings. And, you know, I think that's kind of like a baseline. I had it in me already to kind of be on this path, of course. But when you really do, for anyone, strip away those things that numb us from society or from our physical realm, or even our spiritual or emotional realm, we're just more in tune.
Mm. So I want to continue on this question of these, you know, huge dichotomies. So another one that I'd like to ask you about is, so as you know, as a personal chef, you really deal with the sort of high end of food. Like, food is, you know, delicious, you know, farm fresh, and at the same time, you're really involved in food justice and anti-hunger. And very often those two groups are not talking to each other. Do you know what I mean?
No. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, how did you come to each of those? Like, why? I can say, you know, I know lots of people who are really into fancy food and a lot of people who are really into food justice, and you're into both. How did you get there, and how do you navigate these two communities that very often don't intersect?
Well, I mean, my entertainment background, my professional background of owning a restaurant, of being in that world, I mean, finding my place as an individual and having the fluidity to connect with a lot of different people without necessarily having a brick and mortar space, personal chef for me was the way to go, and consulting was the way to go. And the thing is, yeah, people who can afford a personal chef are, yes, they're into fancy foods, they're into luxury items. But to be honest with you, food culture across the board, no matter what your economic, socioeconomic space is or level of constraint or whatever you want to call it, because it's very constraining and confining, a lot of people just tend to not be in the know of food, you know. Good or bad. I mean, our culture today is that most people today just don't know what real food is, what good real food is, how to access it. It's just that if you have money, then you could access it a lot easier, or you can just pay for someone to prepare for food for you, or you can just go to a restaurant and get what you like. You know, same thing with people who are on the lower end of that totem pole, except the places that they go to are fast food restaurants. You know, and it just sucks for people all around. You know, people can be millionaires and still eat that Special K, which is genetically modified cereal. You know, everyone is affected by this. Me, stepping into this lane, I'm able to bridge that gap between the two groups by way of speaking to my clients, my personal chef clients, about real food culture as I prepare food for them. And you know, just like on a very ground guerrilla style level, invite them out to the organic farms that I volunteer, you know, and so that way they actually can help other people and they can be more involved. And if they have the money and the means to do so, maybe they can be more financially proactive to donate or benefit or help other people that can't help themselves.
Mm. So on your website, you talk about, you know, urban farming programs, and you mentioned permaculture from your high school program. So 5 years ago, I think the words urban farming would have not made a blip on our consciousness. It seems like in the last couple of years, a lot of people have woken up to it, from the work of Will Allen in Milwaukee to Ron Finley's guerrilla gardening in South Central LA. What have you seen over the last few years in terms of urban gardening, urban organic farming as a way of bridging that gap, of saying that people in urban settings, people who have often been traditionally disadvantaged, can actually produce food that's much higher quality than most Americans will eat?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely magnificent. I'm so excited for what's happening. I mean, this, of course, was in my life, my entire life, you know, so for me to see other people who have quit their 9-to-5 to start urban farming programs and to, you know, head up initiatives in their neighborhoods is incredible to me. And I'm really excited about it's like everything is happening. It may seem like it's slowly happening, but it's happening, you know, and I think that's the exciting part, because I'm so curious to know how this is going to pan out another 5 years, you know?
So when you do a lot of work with kids, right, in school system, teaching them about healthy eating, what's that like? What are some, you know, a couple of stories about the impact, you know, things that surprise you and how that can be frustrating and rewarding?
Well, it's all really rewarding, but the biggest thing is that across the board, socioeconomic aside, I mean, kids really are just kind of, you know, kids are kids, and kids, no matter what, are going to be open and receptive and curious and willing to eat healthy and have a healthy life because they want to, because that's just children by nature. You know, it's more so parents who push their habits, their lifestyle, and their means onto their children. But yeah, I mean, you'll have kids who wake up and have to have ramen noodles and soda for breakfast because that's what their parents have access to or afford. But if a kid was given kale, you know, sauteed kale and some quinoa for breakfast and like an avocado, they would eat that too. I know, because I did, you know, because that's the kind of home that I grew up in, you know, but, you know, kids are open and kids are the future in any generation. So, you know, me working with children and encouraging more programs in schools is, you know, and having those schools maintain sustainable programs is the key for the success.
Right. Now, so you clearly promote a plant-based diet, if not an exclusively vegan diet, then certainly very heavily, you know, whole plant foods. It seems like a lot of raw. And in our sort of school food culture, when we talk about, or just the popular culture around healthy food, people don't think that way. Right. So they'll talk about like a Mediterranean diet or a DASH diet or even, you know, paleo, which are all arguably, you know, big improvements over standard American. How do you navigate, you know, coming in and saying, well, this is a healthy way to live versus, you know, the typical, like the American Heart Association, like 2/3 of their recipes have meat in it?
Right. I hit them with facts. For every person that has something to tell me about why somebody needs a steak or throw some chicken in there, I hit people with straight facts. You know, spirulina is more of a complete protein than a steak, than beef. You know what I mean? That's a fact. You can't, I mean, of course you have to ingest more spirulina, more broccoli, more kale. You have to eat more of those things, but it's not more of a complete protein. You know what I mean? Chicken is not better than broccoli or spinach or spirulina, but it's what people are used to. It's like the idea of chewing it. You feel more full. You feel more satisfied. We're conditioned to think that it's better. my current client right now is an NFL football player. And I had to meet with his training coaches and the nutritionist there. And, you know, they, you know, it's like, we're working for the same person, but there's no way you can convince me that, you know, chicken's better than a plant protein.
Mm.
Especially not the conventional kitchen that most people have access to. Chicken.
Right. So you're working with an NFL player.
Yes, I am.
So that's unusual. I know of exactly one other NFL player who adopted a plant-based diet while playing, Tony Gonzalez. There may be others. I know you have an association with Asante Samuel.
My current player right now, his name is Eddie Lacy. He plays for the Green Bay Packers. Eddie's 25. He's going into his third year. His first year, he was like rookie of the year. I'm actually not that well versed in football, but he's an amazing person, and he was all the way gung ho and ready to eat, real or die, and be plant based. And I'm really proud of him. And you know, he has some weight goals, and just to be generally, you know, just more health focused. And he is a really, really great. Optimistic and you know, healthy candidate for this lifestyle. I mean, he's a young guy. He's willing to do it, and that's the first step.
Wow. So did he come to it out of a desire for performance improvement, or did he look at the stats of, like, how well NFL players fare post-career?
No, I mean... Right now, he's a super young guy, like in the prime or before his prime. I mean, he hasn't even reached his prime. And he's an incredible player. He's super strong. And he has some weight goals that he's trying to meet. And of course, you know, there's nothing better than a whole food plant-based diet to keep you fit, you know, lean, and encourage that muscle growth. There are plenty of vegan athletes, plenty. You know, and it's more of a psyche thing than anything else. But once you get over that hurdle, then you're there, and then you feel better, you feel lighter, you feel more clean, you feel just more positive and open and optimistic, and he's there.
That's really cool. And so I know, you know, Asante Samuel is quite the activist. Like someone who, you know, like you, has taken things that the culture appreciates about him, you know, his athleticism, and really turned it into a lot of social advocacy. You mentioned there's a lot of vegan athletes. Do you see a movement there? Like that can be a serious source of sort of, you know, culture slapping to wake us up to the benefits.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, once again, with me and my physical presence and being that kind of carrot that you dangle so people can start to pay attention, like, oh, I like this girl. I like the way she looks. She has a healthy body image. Oh, she just so happens to be plant-based. Well, then maybe I should be inspired to be plant-based, or maybe I am inspired, you know? And there is no way there's no way that people won't be inspired by seeing more plant-based athletes out there to be plant-based themselves.
Right. I remember we lived in New Jersey. There was a family who had very strong religious views, and they were pretty vocal in sharing them with us, a neighbor down the street. And what I remember most is just how miserable they were. You know, and I thought, well,
it's not surprising.
Like, why, you know, if someone was like happy and, you know, the kids were frolicking and they were, you know, doing well, but they were just miserable people. I was like, why would, you know, what a bad advertisement. And so when I see people who are, you know, who fit the cultural norms of success and desired values, whether it's, you know, financial or emotional or physical, you know, I think those are the people who should be, you know, highlighting the lifestyle that will get you that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it's so holistic. You know what I mean? Like, if you have success, and a lot of people, of course, determine success by monetary levels, then, you know, there's, now, of course, not everyone who has a lot of money is a healthy person, but I'm sure they're regimented. I'm sure they're organized. You know what I mean? There's a lot that has to go into it. And a lot of those people eat a certain way, even if it may not be necessarily what they eat, but it's how they eat. It's just a matter of like having the right amount of meals per day, having your meals be balanced so you can think straight. You know what I mean? Kids don't do well in school who, you know, eat poorly or don't eat at all before they get to school.
Right. And I love that holistic outlook, because there's, you know, there's always room for improvement in any one area, but very often people who, you know, like are extreme, like for me, I eat really, really well in terms of the quality of the food I eat. I'm less good about quantity. Like I'll overeat, or yeah, I'll eat unconsciously. And rather than trying to, you know, to go from 99.8% whole food plant-based to 100%, I should just like, you know, sit down, turn off the iPad and chew my food.
Yeah.
Like that, that'll have a much bigger impact on my overall well-being.
Absolutely.
So another thing I want to ask you about is you're a coach on an MTV show called Made, which I guess is in its 14th season now.
Yeah, it's been going a long time.
How did you get that gig?
Well, Made first came my way when I was Miss Pennsylvania. You know, and I, of course, I'm still in the entertainment industry. I still have an agent, that kind of thing. And years ago, when I was still Miss Pennsylvania, or I think maybe had just come off a year later, they first approached me and wanted me to coach someone to be a beauty queen. And I said, no, I'm sorry. I just won't do it. That's not what I want to share with people. I don't want to coach people to be beauty queens because I don't believe in it. You know, I don't believe in what being a beauty, the standard of what being a beauty queen stands for. And
they called you back later.
And they called me back later. Yes. I think my personality and me just, you know, not really wanting to, you know, because, you know, it's like you have the casting process, they get to know you, they put you on camera, but then, you know, when the cameras are off, you still communicate, you still talk to people, you know, the casting directors off camera and that thing. And definitely I would say that my off camera connection with the casting directors is what, you know, solidified me a place with MTV.
Mm-hmm. So the first one, I guess, was working with a teenage boy who was kind of a geek, and he wanted to be better at approaching girls. He wanted to like
Sammy Almastri, yes,
become a ladies' man. What was your thought when they came back to you with that one? Was that sort of an unconditional yes, I support this mission, or did you have reservations about that as well?
No, I actually turned a couple things, two episode concepts down prior to that that were similar. The timing, you know, worked out for me at the time, and I felt that based upon what the specifics were with the circumstance of it being a ladies' man and who he was, I felt that I could really help him, because it was less about being a ladies' man and just more about being a confident person. And that meant so much more to me, of course, than being a ladies' man. Hmm. But it's just about your presentation, how you interact with people and how you present yourself. And some people, you know, don't have that confidence, you know, on their sleeve. And I just had to help him pull it out a little bit.
And so in your qualifications for that, in their eyes, it seemed to be, at least the way the episode was framed that I watched, was, well, you were Miss Pennsylvania 2007, and therefore you were qualified.
Yeah.
Right? But it was clear that, like, that was the least of your qualifications in terms of actually helping him. What did you draw upon to help him and, you know, to help other people become themselves?
Yeah, it was my entire life, to be honest with you. You know, I've always walked to the beat of my own drum. I've always wanted to be everything I could be, you know. It's like when I became the beauty queen, it kind of solidified for me at 21, all of the dreams that I had, I could actually make happen just as myself. I didn't have to be a character, because the idea of like, I think the idea for some actors or actresses when they're on that path is like, oh, I can live all of these experiences, on camera or off camera, but nonetheless, I can live these experiences. And my whole thing is like, well, no, I actually want to live these experiences in real life as myself. I don't want to pretend them. I want to actually experience them and live them. And with all the things that I had gone through, with the brain tumor, with having gone to farm school, having been a model, having been an actress, having had high goals as a very young kid, set me up for just to be in a place where I could even, you know, at a 20 something, inspire someone else to just like go after what it is, whatever they wanted in life.
I guess thinking about it that way, that being a beauty queen and being successful by being yourself is like the ultimate proof. Like, that seems like it's the place where it would be least advantageous to be yourself. And yet, you know, if that's the winning formula there, then, you know, from hard to easy, it's got to be the winning formula everywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, I turned 30 in November, and my goal is to just win at being me, you know, and whatever that I may, hey, tomorrow I may pick up a new goal. You know what I mean? I may decide I want to run for president one day. You know what I mean? And if I hold true to that goal and I want that enough, then, you know, I'm going to have fun riding the wave of that. And that's, you know, that's just my motto. Like, do what you want, do what you feel, do what you're passionate about. Do something that's positive, that's going to change your life and the life of someone else's for the better.
You mentioned you've just moved to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious what your next, you know, couple of years goals are. You've got so much under your belt. You're just turned 30. You've got so much experience. What's calling to you?
I would say my personal goals definitely just rely in, at the end of the day, like being a personal chef, that's the business aspect of my life. Like, I own a business, I'm a business owner, and being financially responsible and being successful in a business, because that's the real thing about business. I mean, we can't ignore that. And I think a lot of things, you know, especially people in my realm, we're very whimsical, you know what I mean? We're very whimsical and spiritual about a lot of the things that we do, but business is business, you know, and I can't be successful at being whimsical if I'm not successful with my finances and with my actual business and being able to even be an inspiration for people in that realm. You know, being an independent entrepreneur, meaning that I don't work for someone who gives me a paycheck every 2 weeks, at least, you know, in a large sum, and I have one role. I actually get a lot of checks and I do a lot of things, which makes things more difficult sometimes. But with that, proven tangible credibility of the success of my business is going to be even more of an inspiration for people to be independent and go out on their own and say no to that 9-to-5 that they thought that they should get or could get when they graduated from college. Because, I mean, I was a film major in college. I knew that it was never going to be easy for me. I wasn't a business major and said, okay, fine, I'm going to go apply for that job and then I'm going to get that job. You know, I said, I'm going into entertainment and I want to have control and I want to be happy. And that has to come with real work, real time, real dedication, real responsibility, real organization, and real commitment to having a viable business. So me being in Atlanta, it's being a real business person. It's being in a city that is going to be able to support the business that I offer. And then furthermore, just continue to build my brand, build my business. Eat, Rule, or Die is an organization that I am... It's more of a movement than I'm starting.
Say the name of it again more slowly.
Eat, Real, or Die.
Eat,
yes.
Real,
it's
or
actually
Die.
Not, Eat Real or Die is it started more of a social media movement or campaign that I created 3 years ago, actually, when I just, you know, really just came to a place where it's like I saw right in front of me very clearly one day what was happening with our world, with our food system, who was controlling what and why they were controlling it. I always had this connection to food, but I was never so political with it. But then when you connect the dots, it's like, I'm sorry, I just can't let this happen. You know, I just can't sit back and allow my life to be controlled in this way and let the lives of other people who really trust our world and really trust the powers that be and that omnipresent they to do things for the better when they're really doing it for the worst and for themselves for selfish reasons. And that's not fair.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, so I mean, just continue on with Eat, Will, or Die. Part of Eat, Will, or Die, there's a program that I have called Eat Real and Grow. And that is picking off in Westchester, Pennsylvania, at the University of Westchester, where I have a team there starting a chapter there. And the goal of that chapter is to create and support a sustainable community garden on the campus. And then the goal is to take that to other campuses and other schools and elementary schools and high schools who don't have that.
Nice. Yeah, and I really appreciate the links that you've made between, you know, being responsible as a human being around food justice, around politics, and entrepreneurship. Because, you know, I consider myself unemployable. I was able to do a decent job as a school teacher because it was so heavily mission driven. But in the business world, it quickly became apparent that I could never work for anybody else. I could never do the 9 to 5. And I've just, you know, and when you jump into that, it's a really good way to discover all the ways in which you are still a child, all the ways in which
Absolutely.
You have magical thinking, in which you have entitlements, in which you are full of fear and greed and selfishness. And you know, for me, the entrepreneurial journey has been at least as important as my food journey for, you know, sort of kind and really harsh feedback from the world about being a grown-up.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I come from an entrepreneurial family. My mom's a chef, my dad is an artist, and, you know, they come from very strong foundations of what they were raised in. But, you know, I come from very, you know, free-spirited, whimsical kind of, but serious and driven parents. And so I always had that edge in me. And I come from a great home and I had great things. And, you know, but I didn't have everything I wanted, you know. But and as I've grown up and grown older, you know, there were times that I had a 9 to 5 and I worked in restaurants that my mom didn't own or that I didn't even own. But then, you know, at 24, when I owned Soul, which was the name of my restaurant that I owned, I felt like I was 44. And I said, you know, I have the 3-year plan, but I don't know if this plan is encompassing everything that actually I am passionate about and makes me feel as though I'm fulfilled. And it has been a very long 6 years. It's been a very long 6 years, but I haven't, and never one moment did I feel that I was not living. You know, I've lived and felt every second of every minute of day, month, year that has gone by from the moment that I decided that I was going to walk away from my business and I moved to Italy. And that's when I created the first incarnations of my business. My LLC is called Terra to Table. And then I was growing organic herbs from seed and I was consulting with people. I was still writing TV treatments and film treatments. And then I came back to the States and I went to NYU for producing for a little bit. And then I've just been on this path, developing who I am as an individual, what I care about, what connects to me, And what's and like everything that I do is just a part of an extension of my passions in life. That's it. That's it. That is it. You know, and I'm just really thankful that I have that in me. I mean, if I didn't have it in me, I'm sure I would be content at being whoever I would be otherwise. But I'm really, I like me and I like what I do. And I'm happy that the things that I enjoy in life are positive and I can help other people. Like Eat Real or Die, Eat Real and Grow, you know, even working with my personal chef clients. It's not about me, it's about them. It's about how can I help other people? You know, in my own way, I'm here as being of service, you know, and if I can win and be successful in that way, then I'm good.
Right. It's a nice breath of fresh air because, you know, as a food activist these days, it's very easy to become pessimistic, to focus on disease, to focus on environmental problems, to focus on animal cruelty, to focus on GMOs. To really talk about all the negatives, and I am prone to that, right? I discover, you know, I just was talking to someone locally about a health partnership, and before we met, he read my website, and he wrote all these comments about like, boy, this is really negative, and I looked at it afterwards, and I said, he's right. I was in a bad mood, and for you to be driven by. It sounds like not by fear, but by passion, not by fear of missing out, but by flowering of self-expression and service. I think that energy must inform everything, even if it's in the context of fighting against a negative.
Yeah. I mean, it's like if we just focus on doing what we should do, then all those things that we're afraid of or that we feel angry about or we feel used and lied to about will change anyway. You know what I mean? Eat more plants. That means you won't eat that meat. You won't eat that burger. Those people are going to lose money on that. They're going to have to downsize their businesses. They're not going to have, you know, be able to have as much production of, animal protein, and they're not going to raise animals for food, and we're going to end that suffering there. We're going to change the environment. We're going to change that stream off of those toxic chemicals that run into our waterways, you know, from the factory farms. And there isn't going to be so much plastic going into the ocean because we won't buy that plastic bottle. It's like everything we do the right way is going to change all the things that are happening the wrong way.
Right, and all those little steps, as you said about urban agriculture, just it doesn't seem like there's much progress for moment to moment. But when you add it all up, it can be significant.
Yeah, I mean, hey, it takes some time for a seed to grow. You know, that's just the nature of it. I mean, you're not going to have that organic zucchini and kale and squash grow overnight. You have to be patient, and that's just with the movement in itself. You know, these gardens legit, like, really do have to physically, tangibly grow to happen. And, you know, the most we could do is set up those planter boxes, you know, make those boxes, put those pots in our windows, set up those hanging wall planters, and, you know, encourage more growth, and then we will grow.
Nice. One of my favorite songs is... by Chris Smithers. I think he spent a lot of time in New Orleans. I think he grew up around New Orleans. So coming back to the Creole influence. And he writes a song about the vegetable peddlers who used to walk down the streets, you know, singing their wares, you know, sweet corn, Marleton. And he wrote a song about it called No Love Today. And the last two lines are, like, really in keeping with what we're talking about. He says, in the end, no one can sell you what you need. You can't buy it off the shelf. You've got to grow it from the seed.
It's absolutely true. I said something last night that is in the same kind of theme of that, of course, of what we're speaking about. It's, today we're living in a society where every piece of us is currency, is for sale. Mm-hmm. Our health is for sale. what we eat is for sale, where we live is for sale, what we drive, how we get to work, our jobs are for sale. You know, everything about our existence on this planet is for sale. And the only way we will have a healthy life is if we take ownership back. Right now, we are being sold our health. People are selling our health because they're making us sick, and then we have to buy medicine to make us healthy again, which isn't making us healthy anyway. When we possess it to begin with, we just have to take it back.
Right. And the fact that we are so commoditized really blinds us to the fact that we are infinitely unique, right? Because if you're a commodity, yeah, if you're a pork belly or a ton of iron or a dollar bill, you're the same as every other pork belly or ton of iron or dollar bill. And I think it's one of the great fundamental tragedies of our civilization is that people aren't raised to see that they are unique, that they are of infinite worth, and no amount of money can compensate for their existence or the loss of it.
You're absolutely right. I mean, if take away the ownership and take away that commodity aspect of it, it's like prior to our existence, or we could just say living off the grid in some capacity, or being a farmer where you live independently. There's that infinity there. It's up in the air. You know what I mean? We exist within one. There's nothing attached to us. We are free, independent beings. You know, outside of that, or on the inside, rather, what we exist in now today is quite the opposite.
Right. And I really resonate with people's fear about, you know, having faith, because I've planted seeds in the ground. And when you put a seed in the ground, you really have to have a lot of faith to think that teeny thing in the dirt is going to produce anything. Like it can seem very unlikely from our disconnected, materialistic, for sale perspective, that there's this force in the universe that can turn that speck, that little broccoli seed, into nourishment for a family.
Yeah. I mean, that's life. That's what it is. You got to have faith. As George Michael said, you know, that's just all it is. You have to have faith. It's not just faith. It's having certainty. And having certainty is when you don't have the answers in front of you, but it's being positive and knowing the outcome, even when you don't have the outcome in front of you, whether it's going to go either way. That's certainty. Certainty is being certain in the uncertainty, you know, and that's positivity. That's seeing the light in things. That's not seeing the bad. That's just seeing the light. That's just seeing what you want. It's like, if you see your garden, if you can visualize your garden will grow, because you will just make it happen. And you'll just run as a machine in terms of, you know, just doing what you have to do, whether it's, oh, you see, maybe you need to add more nitrogen, or the leaves are a little yellow. What do I do? You just autopilot. Okay, let's do it. Let's get it done. You're not thinking about how much of a drag it is to do it. It's just a part of the process, because, I mean, farming is not easy, you know what I mean? But it's not that difficult. It's just the process. It is what it is, you know. But when you visualize your garden being, successful and flourishing, then it will.
Right. And I think a lot of people mistake that for mystical thinking.
Yes. The secret isn't a secret. I mean, the secret is that you actually do have to manifest. But a part of that manifestation is physically doing things. You can't just sit on a stool somewhere in a corner and expect all this magic to happen. You have to get in the game.
Right. And I think that's the gift that I hear you bringing, is a sense of certainty in the midst of that uncertainty that I think is inspiring people everywhere you go to raise their game and be of service. So Samantha Carey Johnson, thank you so much for taking an hour out of your incredibly busy and fruitful life to share your story.
Thank you. No, I'm so honored that you even asked me. Anything I can do to help and spread the word of, eating real and dying rather, and you know, just being more open and positive about the success of us as a people on Earth is I'm willing to do it.
Right on. It's great having you as an ally.
Thank you. Likewise.
Be well.
Thank you.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast. If you'd like to support the show, you can become a patron and donate some money to the running of the show. You can go to plantyourself.com, and on the sidebar, there is a donate feature. You can also share this with friends, share it on social media, and leave a review on iTunes and some stars. That helps other people find out about the show. In garden news, we had our first couple of frosts this week, so we've officially switched from summer garden to fall garden. The little greens seedlings, the cruciferous vegetables, the broccoli, the kale, the collards, the Moruba Santo, the mustard greens are all incongruously pushing their way up, these tender green young shoots pushing their way up through the fall soil with overcast skies, with frozen nights. And so whatever in your life is green and tender and ultimately nourishing, care for it, water it, protect it from the elements. And if you're having trouble having faith in its eventual growth, then get outside and look to the garden and look to nature for inspiration. And as always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.